none of it making any sense anyway. She looked around for something to smother the flames, snatched up one of the sleeping bags, blue and slippery and smelling faintly of puke. She held her Scrabble sack under one arm while she crammed the sleeping bag in on top of the flames, pressing down hard, choking the fire. She flinched from the heat and the smell, an odor of cooked phosphorus and burned metal and charring nylon. When she looked up again, the boy was gone. "Get the fuck out of my library, you little creep! Get the fuck gone before I catch up to you!" He laughed somewhere. It was hard to tell where he was. His laughter was a breathless, echoing, untraceable sound, like a bird flapping its wings high in the rafters of some abandoned church. She thought, randomly, "God burned alive. Only devils now." She went on toward the lobby, her legs shaking. If she caught the crazy, drunk little bastard, he would not think God had burned alive. He would think God was a dyke librarian, and he would know the fear of her. Maggie was halfway across the periodicals room when the rocket went off with a great whistling scream. That sound was a jolt straight to the nerve endings, made her want to scream herself and dive for cover. Instead she ran, ducked low like a soldier under fire, all the breath shooting out of her. She made it to the vast central room with the 60-foot-high ceilings, in time to see the bottle rocket hit the roof, spin, bounce off an arch, and ricochet down toward the dull marble floor, a missile of emerald flame and crackling sparks. A chemical-smelling smoke coiled throughout the room. Embers of fey green light tumbled from above, falling like flakes of some infernal radioactive snow. Burn the place down! The fucking pint-sized lunatic was in here to burn the place down! The rocket was still flying, hit the wall to her right, and exploded in a bright, fizzling flash with a crack like a gunshot, and she shouted and ducked and covered the side of her face. An ember touched the bare skin of her right forearm, and she flinched at the sharp stab of pain. In the far room, the reading room, the boy laughed breathlessly and ran on. The rocket was out, but the smoke in the lobby still flickered, glowing an unearthly jade hue. Maggie charged after him, beyond thought now, rattled and angry and afraid. The boy couldn't escape through the front door. That was locked from the outside with a chain. But there was a fire door in the reading room that the bums kept propped open. Beyond was the eastern parking lot. She could catch him there. She didn't know what she'd do with him when she had her hands on him, and a part of her was scared to find out. As she hit the reading room, she saw the door to the outside already settling shut. "You shit!" she whispered. "You shit!" She slammed through the door and out into the parking lot. Across the paved expanse, a single functioning street lamp cast a nimbus of light. The center of the lot was brightly lit, but the edges were in darkness. The boy waited beside the lamppost. Little bastard had another sparkler going and was standing not far from a dumpster filled with books. "Are you out of your gosh darn mind?" Maggie said. The boy shouted, "I see you through my magic window!" He drew a burning hoop in the air at the level of his face. "Now your head is burning! You start a fire in there and someone could get killed, you little asshole!" Maggie said. "Like you!" She was short of breath and trembling, and her extremities prickled strangely. She clutched her Scrabble bag in one sweat-damp hand. She began stalking across the lot. Behind her, the fire door clicked shut. God damn it. The kid had kicked away the stone that kept it from locking. She needed to go all the way around the building to get back inside now. "Look!" the child cried. "Look! I can write in flames!" He slashed the tip of the sparkler in the air, a white spoke of light so intense it left a glowing afterimage on Maggie's optic nerve, creating the illusion of pulsing letters in the air. R-U-N. "Who are you?" she asked, swaying a little herself, catching in place halfway across the lot, not sure she had just seen what she thought she'd seen, that he had spelled what she thought he'd spelled. "Look! I can make a snowflake! I can make Christmas in July!" And he drew a snowflake in the air. Her arms bristled with goose flesh. "Wayne?" "Yes?" "Oh, Wayne," she said. "Oh, God!" A pair of headlights snapped on in the shadows beyond a dumpster, off to her right. A car idled along the curb, an old car with close-set headlamps, so black she had not seen it in the greater darkness around it. "Hello," called a voice from somewhere behind those headlights. He was on the passenger side of the car. No, wait, the driver's side. It was all reversed on a British car.
"What a night to go driving. Come on over, Miss Margaret Lee. It is Margaret Lee, isn't it? You look just like your photograph in the paper."
Maggie squinted into the headlights. She was telling herself to move, get out of the middle of the parking lot, but her legs were stuck in place. The fire door was an impossible distance away, 12 steps that might as well have been 1,200, and anyway, she had heard it clap shut behind her. It occurred to her that there was, at best, a minute or so left to her life. She asked herself if she was ready for it. Thoughts darted like sparrows racing in the dusk, just when she most desperately wanted her mind to be still. "He doesn't know Vic is here," she thought. And, get the boy and get him away. And, why doesn't Wayne just run? Because he couldn't anymore. Because he didn't know he was supposed to. Or he knew, but couldn't act on it. But he had tried to tell her to run, had written it in flame on the darkness, had maybe even been trying, in his garbled way, to warn her in the library. "Mr. Manx!" Maggie called, still unable to move her feet.
"You've been looking for me all your life, Miss Lee," he shouted. "Well, here I am at last. I am sure you have lots of questions for me. I know I have lots of questions for you. Come sit with us. Come have an ear of corn."
"Let the Maggie began, then choked up, couldn't force it out, her tongue as helpless as her legs. She wanted to say, "Let the boy go," but her stammer wouldn't let her have that.
"Cat got your tongue," Max shouted.
"Fuck you," she said. There, that came out clean and clear, and F had always been one of her toughest letters.
"Get over here, you scrawny bitch," Charlie Max said. "Get in the car. Either you're riding with us or we're riding over you. Last chance."
She breathed deeply and smelled waterlogged books, the perfume of rotting cardboard and paper that had dried beneath the furnace of the July sun. If a single breath could summarize an entire life, she supposed that would do. It was almost time. It came to her then that she had nothing left to say to Max. She had said it all. She turned her head and fixed her gaze on Wayne. "You have to run, Wayne! Run and hide!" His sparkler had gone out. A grimy smoke trickled away from it.
"Why would I do that?" he said.
"Sorry, he coughed. His frail shoulders jumped.
"We're going to Christmasland tonight. It's going to be fun. Sorry, so I'm..."
He coughed again, then shrieked.
"How about you run instead? That would be a fun game. Myself to on hold, can't I?"
Tires whined shrilly on the asphalt. Her paralysis broke, or maybe she had never been paralyzed. Maybe her muscles and nerves, the meat and wiring, had always understood what the conscious mind didn't want to know, that it was already too late to get out of the way. She bolted across the lot, toward Wayne, some unformed, absurd notion in her head that she could get to him, pull him into the woods, into safety. She crossed in front of the wraith. An icy light rose around her. The engine roared. She glanced sidelong, thinking, "Please let me be ready." And the car was there, the grill so close that her heart seemed to fill her mouth. He was not aiming the rolls at her, but instead rushing up alongside and past her. He had one hand on the wheel and was stretching his upper body out the open window. The wind sucked his black hair back from his high, bare brow. His eyes were wide and avid with hilarity, and there was a look of triumphant joy stamped across his face. In his right hand, he held a silver hammer as big as a god. She did not feel the mallet connect with the back of her neck. There was a sound, like she had stepped on a light bulb. A pop and a crack. She saw a flash, a white, brilliant blink of light. Her fedora whirled away like a tossed frisbee. Her feet continued racing over the blacktop, but when she looked down, they were pedaling in air, she had been lifted right off the ground.
Maggie hit the side of the car as she came down. She spun and struck the asphalt and rolled, arms flying. She went over and over and wound up against the far curb on her back. Her cheek was pressed to the rough blacktop. Poor Maggie, Maggie thought, with genuine, if somewhat muted, sympathy. She found she could not lift her head or even turn it. At the periphery of her vision, she could see that her left leg was bent inward at the knee, the hinge folding in a direction in which it was never meant to go. Her velvet sack of letters had hit near her head and vomited tiles across the parking lot. She saw an H, an M, a U, some other letters. You could spell hum with that.
Do you know you're dying, Miss Lee?
No, but hum a few bars and I'll fake it, she thought, and coughed in a way that might have been laughter. She blew a pink bubble from her lips. When had her mouth got all full of blood?
Wayne stepped down into the parking lot, swinging his arms back and forth. His face had a white, sick gleam to it, but he was smiling to show a mouthful of shiny new teeth. Tears tracked down his face.
You look funny, he said. That was funny,
blinking at tears. He wiped the back of one hand thoughtlessly across his face, spreading a bright streak across his downy cheek. The car idled 10 feet away. The driver's side door opened, boots scraped on the blacktop.
I did not think there was anything funny about her falling into the side of the wraith, Mank said. There is one hell of a dent in the side of my wraith now. To be fair, there is a bigger dent in this scrawny bitch. Back in the car, Wayne. We have to make some miles if we're going to reach Christmasland before sunup.
Wayne sank to one knee beside her. His tears had left red lines on his pale cheeks.
Your mother loves you, Maggie imagined telling him, but all that came out was a wheeze and blood.
She tried to tell him with her eyes instead. She wants you back.
Maggie reached for his hand, and Wayne took hers and squeezed.
Sorry I'm, he said. It help couldn't.
It's all right,
she whispered, not really saying it, just moving her lips. Wayne let go of her hand.
You rest, he said to her. You just rest here. Dream something nice. Dream about Christmas land.
He hopped to his feet and trotted out of sight. A door opened. A door closed. Maggie's gaze shifted to Manx's boots. He was almost standing on her scattering of scrabble tiles. She could see other letters now. A P, an R, a T, an I. Could make trip with that.
I think he broke my neck. What a trip, she thought, and smiled again. What are you smiling about? Manx asked, his voice shuddering with hate. You have nothing to smile about. You are going to be dead, and I am going to be alive. You could have lived too, you know, for another day, anyway. There were things I wanted to know, like who else you told about me. I wanted, don't you look away from me when I am talking to you.
She had shut her eyes. She didn't want to stare at his upside-down face from here on the ground. It wasn't that he was ugly. It was that he was stupid. It was the way his mouth hung open to show his overbite and his crooked brown teeth. It was the way his eyes bulged from his skull. He put his boot in her stomach. If there was any justice, she wouldn't have been able to feel it. But there was no justice, and never had been, and she screamed.
Who knew you could hurt so bad and not pass out from it? You listen now. You did not have to die like this. I am not such a bad fellow. I am a friend to children and wish no ill will on anyone except those who would try to stop my work. You did not have to line up against me, but you did, and look where it has got you. I am going to live forever, and so is the boy. We will be living the good life while you are turning to dirt in a box, and...
She got it then. Strung the letters together, saw what they spelled. She got it. And she made a huffing sound, blowing a spray of blood on Manx's boots. It was an unmistakable sound, the sound of laughter. Manx scuttled backward half a foot, as if she had tried to bite him.
What's funny? What's so funny about you dying and me living? I am going to drive away, and no one is going to stop me, and you are going to bleed to death here, and where is the big laugh in that?
She tried to tell him. She moved her lips in the shape of the word, but all she could do was wheeze and spray more blood. She had lost all power of speech, and at this notion she felt a sweet tingle of relief. No more stammering. No more trying desperately to make herself understood while her tongue refused to cooperate. Manx rose to his full height, kicking the letters as he stood, scattering them. Scattering what they spelled, if you took the time to see how to put them together. Triumph. He walked quickly away, pausing only to collect her hat from the pavement, dust off the brim, and set it on his own head. A door slammed. The radio turned on. She heard the jingle of Christmas bells and a warm male voice singing, "Dashing Through the Snow." The car jolted into gear and started to move. Maggie closed her eyes. Triumph. 45 points if you could line it up with the triple word and a double letter. Triumph, Maggie thought. Vic wins. Hampton Beach, New Hampshire. Vic pushed through the door into Terry's Primo Subs, where the air was warm and damp and heavy with the smell of onion rings broiling in the deep-fat fryer. Pete was working the counter, good old Pete, his face badly sunburned, a line of zinc down his nose.
"I know what you're here for," Pete said, reaching under the counter. "I've got something for you."
"No," Vic said. "I don't give a fuck about my mother's bracelet. I'm looking for Wayne. Did you see Wayne?" It confused her to find herself back in Terry's, ducking under the ribbons of flypaper. Pete couldn't help her find Wayne. She was angry with herself, wasting time here when she needed to be out there looking for her boy. A police siren shrieked out on the avenue. Maybe someone had seen the wraith. Maybe they had found her son.
"No," Pete said. "It's not a bracelet. It's something else."
He ducked behind the cash register, then stood up and put a silver hammer down on the counter. There was blood and hair stuck to the business end. Vic felt the dream drawing tight around her, as if the world were a giant cellophane bag, and it was suddenly wrinkling and pulling in from all sides. "No," Vic said. "I don't want it. That's not what I came for. That's no good." Outside, the police siren cut off with a strangled squonk.
"I think it's good," said Charlie Manx, his hand on the cross-hatched handle.
It had been Charlie Manx on the other side of the counter all along. Charlie Manx dressed like a cook, in a blood-stained apron and a cocked white hat, a line of zinc down his bony nose.
"And what's good stays good, no matter how many heads you split open with it."
He lifted the hammer, and Vic screamed and threw herself back from him and right out of the dream, into
real life.
Vic woke, aware that the hour was late and that something was wrong. She could hear voices, muted by stone and distance, could identify the speakers as male, even if she could not determine what they were saying. She smelled the faintest whiff of burned phosphorus. She had the muddled idea that she'd slept right through a commotion, sealed in the soundproofed sarcophagus fashioned by Maggie's pharmaceuticals. She rolled herself up to a sitting position, feeling she ought to get dressed and go. After a few moments, she determined she was already dressed. She had not even removed her sneakers before falling asleep. Her left knee was a poisonous shade of violet and as fat as one of Lou's knees. A red candle burned in the darkness, reflecting an image of itself in the fish tank's glass. There was a note over on the desk. Maggie had left her a note before going. That was thoughtful of her. Vic could see her .38 caliber paperweight, Chekhov's gun, holding it down. Vic was hoping for instructions, a set of simple steps that would bring Wayne back to her, make her leg better, make her head better, make her life better. Barring that, just a note saying where Maggie had gone would be all right. "Ran to the Night Owl for ramen and drugs. Will be right back. XOXO. Vic heard the voices again. Someone kicked a beer can, not far away. They were moving toward her. They were close. and if she didn't blow out the candle, they were going to wander into the old children's wing and see the light shining through the fish tank. Even as this thought came to her, she understood that it was already almost too late. She heard glass crunching underfoot, boot heels moving closer. She sprang up, her knee collapsed. She dropped onto it, bit down on a scream. When Vic tried to stand, the leg refused to cooperate. She stretched it out behind her with great care, shutting her eyes and pushing through the pain, and then dragged herself across the floor, using her knuckles and her right foot. What it saved in agony, it made up for in humiliation. Her right hand grabbed the back of the rolling chair. Her left took the edge of the desk. She used the two to hoist herself up and sway forward over the desktop. The men were in the other room, right on the other side of the wall. Their flashlights had not yet swung toward the fish tank, and she thought it possible they had not observed the dim, coppery shine of the candle flame yet. And she bent forward to blow it out, then caught herself staring down at the note written on a sheet of Here Library stationery. "When the angels fall, the children go home." The paper was spattered with water stains, as if long ago someone had read this message and wept. Vic heard one of the voices in the next room. "Hank, we got a light." This was followed a moment later by a crackle of voices on a walkie-talkie, a dispatcher passing along a message in numbered code. There was a 1057 at the public library. 6 officers responding. Victim dead on the scene. Vic had bent to put out the candle, but victim dead stopped her. She leaned forward, lips pursed, but had forgotten what she'd intended to do. The door behind her moved, wood scraping against stone, hitting some loose glass and sending it tinkling. "Excuse me," came the voice behind her. "Ma'am, could you step over here? Please keep your hands in full sight." Vic picked up Chekhov's gun and turned around with it and pointed it at his chest. "No." There were 2 of them. Neither had his gun out, and she was not surprised. She doubted if most police officers unsnapped their holsters in the line of duty even once in an average year. Chubby white boys, the both of them. The one in front pointed a powerful penlight at her. The other was stuck in the doorway behind him, still half in the children's library. "Hey!" squeaked the boy with the light. "Gun! Gun!" "Shut up. Stay where you are," she said. "Keep your hands away from your belts, and drop that flashlight. It's right in my fucking eyes." The cop dropped it. It shut off the moment it fell from his hand, clattered across the floor. They stood there, freckled and dumpy and scared, the candlelight rising and falling over their faces. One of them was probably coaching his son's Little League team tomorrow. The other probably liked being a cop because it meant free milkshakes at McDonald's. They reminded her of kids playing dress-up. "Who's dead?" she said. "Ma'am, you need to put that gun down. No one wants to get hurt tonight," he said. His voice wavered and cracked like an adolescent boy's. "Who?" she said, her voice choking up on her, wavering at the edge of a scream. "Your radio said someone is dead. Who? Tell me now." "Some woman," said the guy in back, stuck in the doorway. The guy in front had raised his hands, palms out. She couldn't see what the other guy was doing with his hands, probably drawing his gun, but he didn't matter yet. He was jammed behind his partner, would have to shoot through him to get her. "No ID." "What color was her hair?" Vic cried. The second man said, "Did you know her?" "What color was her fucking hair?" "It had orange sprayed into it, like orange soda colored. You know her?" asked the second cop, the one who probably had his gun out. It was difficult to work the fact of Maggie's death into her mind. It was like being asked to multiply fractions while suffering from a head cold. Too much work. Too baffling. Only a moment ago, they had been stretched out on the couch together, Maggie's arm over her waist and her legs against the backs of Vic's thighs. The heat of her had put Vic right to sleep. It amazed Vic that Maggie had slipped off to die someplace while Vic herself slept on. It was bad enough that only a few days before, Vic had yelled at Maggie, had cursed and threatened her. This seemed far worse, graceless and inconsiderate, for Vic to sleep peacefully while Maggie died somewhere out in the street. "How?" Vic asked. "Car, maybe. Looks like she got clipped by a car. Jesus!
Just put the gun down. Put the gun down, and let's talk.
Let's not, Vic said, and turned her head and blew out the candle, dropping all three of them into
the dark. Vic didn't try to run. Might as well try to fly.
Instead, she stepped rapidly backward, around the desk and against the wall, keeping the cops in front of her. The blackness was absolute, was a geography of blindness. One of the cops shouted, stumbled in the dark. There was a scuffle of boot heels. Vic believed that the one in back had pushed the other out of his way. She tossed the paperweight. It made a banging, sliding, rattling thud as it skidded away from her across the floor. Something for them to think about, confuse them about where she was. Vic began to move, keeping the left leg stiff, trying not to put much weight on it. She sensed rather than saw an iron bookshelf on her left and slipped behind it. Somewhere in the blind night world, a cop knocked over the broom leaning against the wall. It fell with a bang, followed by a yelp of fright. Her foot found the edge of a step.
"If you ever need to get out in a hurry, stay right and keep going down the steps," Maggie had told her.
Vic couldn't remember when. There was a way out of all this darkness, somewhere at the bottom of an unguessable number of stairs. Vic descended. She moved in a hop, and once her heel came down on a wet, spongy book and she nearly landed on her ass. Vic fell against the wall, steadied herself, and continued. Somewhere behind her she heard shouts, more than two men now. Her breath rasped in her throat, and it occurred to her again that Maggie was dead. Vic wanted to cry for her, but her eyes were so dry they hurt. She wanted Maggie's death to make everything quiet and still, the way it was supposed to be in a library, but instead everything was bellowing cops and whistling breaths and the knocking of her own pulse. She hopped down a last short flight of steps and saw a slash of nighttime darkness standing out against the fuller, more complete darkness of the stacks. The back door stood partly open, held ajar by a chunk of rock. Vic slowed as she approached it, expecting to peer out and see a festival of cops in the muddy field behind the library. But when she looked, there was no one. They were all on the far eastern side of the building. Her motorcycle stood alone, close to the bench where she had left it. The Cedar River bubbled and churned. The shorter way was not there, but then she hadn't expected it to be. She yanked the door open and ducked out under yellow tape, holding the left leg stiff, chugging along in her crooked hop. The sound of police scanners carried on the rich, damp heat of the night. She could not see the cop cars, but one of them had its party lights on, and the strobe flashed against the low, cloudy murk above the library. Vic climbed onto the Triumph, threw the kickstand up, stomped on the starter. The Triumph boomed. The rear door of the library opened. The cop who came through it, tearing down the tape as he spilled outside, had his gun in both hands, pointed at the ground. Vic turned the Triumph in a slow, tight circle, wanting the bridge to be there, spanning the Cedar River. It wasn't. She was cruising along at less than 5 miles an hour, and that simply wasn't fast enough. She had never found the shorter way going so slowly. It was a matter of speed and emptiness, shutting her head off and riding.
"You! Get off the bike!" the cop yelled. He began to jog toward her, pointing his gun off to one side.
She steered the Triumph up the narrow road that ran behind the library, banged it into second gear, and gunned it up the hill. The wind snatched at her bloody, matted hair. Vic cycled up the back road and around to the front of the building. The library fronted a wide avenue, crowded with police cruisers, the night twitching with strobes. At the sound of her engine, men in blue turned their heads to look. There was a small crowd as well, held back by yellow sawhorses, dark figures craning their necks, hoping to see a little blood. One of the cruisers was parked right across the narrow road that looped behind the library.
"You're boxed in, shithead," she thought.
She wheeled the Triumph around, back the way she had come. The Triumph dropped down the pitch of the road as if it were dropping over a cliff. She threw it into third gear, continuing to accelerate. She rushed past the library, over on her left. She dived down toward that muddy half-acre field where Maggie had been waiting for her. A cop waited there now, next to Maggie's bench. Vic had the Triumph up to almost 40 by now. She pointed it toward the river. Just work, you motherfucker, she said. I don't have time for your bullshit. She banged it into fourth gear. Her lone headlight rushed across the blacktop, over the dirt, out onto the muddy brown turmoil of the river. She rushed toward the water. Maybe, if she were very lucky, she would drown. Better than getting fished out and locked up and knowing that Wayne was going to Christmasland and she couldn't do a thing about it. Vic shut her eyes and thought, fuck it, fuck it, fuck it, fuck it. They were perhaps the only true words of prayer she had ever been able to utter with all her heart. Her ears roared with the sound of her own blood. The bike slammed up onto the muddy ground, punched across it toward the river, and then she heard wood hammering under the tires and the bike began to slew and slip. She opened her eyes, found herself shuddering through the darkness across the rotting old boards of the Shorter Way Bridge. At the other end was only darkness. The roaring in her ears was not blood at all, but static. A storm of white light whirled between the cracks in the walls. The whole lopsided bridge seemed to shudder around her under the weight of the bike. She rushed past her old cobwebbed Raleigh and was pitched out into damp, buggy, pine-scented darkness, her back tire clawing at soft earth. Vic planted her foot on the brake that didn't work and grabbed reflexively at the brake that did. The bike turned sideways and slid. The ground was covered in a springy bed of moss, and the Triumph bunched it up under its tires like loose carpet. Vic was on a slight embankment, out in the piney woods somewhere. Water dripped in the branches, although it was not actually raining. She kept the bike up while it did a sideways judder across the ground, then cut the engine, snapped down the kickstand. She looked back into the bridge. At the far end, she could see the library and that freckled, way-faced cop standing at the entrance to the Shorter Way. He rotated his head slowly, looking at the entrance to the bridge. In another moment, he would step inside. Vic squeezed her eyes shut and lowered her head. The left eye hurt, as if it were a metal bolt being screwed into the socket. "Go away!" she yelled, gritting her teeth. There was a great clap of sound, as if someone had slammed an enormous door, and a shockwave of hot air, air that smelled like ozone, like a burned metal pan, was flung out at her, almost blew over the bike, and her with it. She looked up. At first she could not see much through the left eye. Her vision out of that eye was obscured by blurred patches, like splashes of muddy water on a window. But from the other she could see that the bridge had popped out of existence, leaving behind tall pines, the reddish trunks glistening from a recent rain. And what had happened to the cop at the other end? Vic wondered if he'd put a foot over the threshold, or stuck in his head. What happened if some part of him was over the edge, on the bridge? She visualized a child poking fingers under a paper cutter and then bringing the long blade down. "You can't do anything about that now," she said, and shuddered. Vic turned, taking in her surroundings for the first time. She was behind a single-story log house, light glowing in a kitchen window. Beyond it, on the other side of the cabin, was a long gravel lane leading back to a road. She had never seen the place before, but she thought she knew where she was, and in another moment she was sure. As she stood astraddle her bike, the back door opened, and a small, thin man appeared behind the screen, looking up the hill at her. He had a cup of coffee in one hand. She could not see his face, but recognized him by shape alone, by the tilt of his head, even though she had not seen him in more than 10 years. She was at her father's house at last. She had given the cops the slip and made it back to Chris McQueen. Dover, New Hampshire. A loud clap like the world's biggest door slamming shut. An electronic squeal. A deafening roar of static. Tabitha Hutter shouted and flung her headphones down. Daltrey, sitting on her right, flinched but kept his own headphones on for a moment longer, his face screwed up in pain. "What just happened?" Hutter asked Cundy. Five of them were packed in the rear of a panel truck that said King Board Deli on the side. Fitting, considering they were jammed in like sausages. The truck was parked next to a Citgo station. across the road and 100 feet south of the drive that led up to Christopher McQueen's house. They had teams in the woods, closer into McQueen's cabin, shooting video and using parabolic microphones to listen in. The footage and sound were being broadcast back to the truck. Until a moment ago, Hutter had been able to see the driveway on a pair of monitors, rendered in the supernatural emerald of night vision. Now, though, they showed only a blizzard of green snow. The picture had gone out at the same time they lost their sound. One moment Hutter had been listening to Chris McQueen and Louis Carmody speaking in low voices in the kitchen. McQueen had been asking Lou if he wanted coffee. In the next instant, they were gone, replaced by a furious blast of radio hiss. "Don't know," Cundy said. "Everything just went down." He jabbed at the keyboard of his little laptop, but the screen was a smooth face of black glass. "It's like we got hit with a motherfucking EMP." Cundy was funny when he swore. A dainty little black man with a piping voice and the trace of a British accent, pretending he was street instead of MIT. Daltrey tugged his own headphones off. He peeked down at his watch and laughed, a dry, startled sound that had nothing to do with amusement. "What?" Hutter asked. Daltrey turned his wrist so she could see the face of his watch. It looked almost as old as he was, a watch with a clock face and a tarnished silver band that had probably been tinted to look like gold once upon a time. The second hand rolled around and around, moving backward. The hour and minute hands had both frozen perfectly still. "It killed my watch," he said. He laughed again, this time looking toward Cundy. "Did all this shit do that? All your electronics? Did all this shit just blow up and wipe out my watch?" "I don't know what did it," Cundy said. "Maybe we was touched by lightning." "What fucking lightning? You hear any thunder?" "I did hear a loud clap," Hutter said, "just as everything cut out." Daltrey put a hand in the pocket of his coat, tugged out his cigarettes, then seemed to remember that Hutter was sitting beside him, and gave her a sidelong glance of wry disappointment. He let the pack slip back into his pocket. "How long will it take to get video and sound restored?" Hutter asked. "It could have been a sunspot," Cundy said, as if she hadn't spoken. "I've heard the sun is kicking up with a solar storm." "Sunspot," Daltrey said. He placed his palms together, as in prayer. "You think sunspot, huh? You know, I can just tell you went to 6 years of college and majored in neuroscience or something. Because only a truly gifted mind could talk himself into such utter horseshit. It's dark out, you autistic fuck." "Cundy," Hutter said, before Cundy could come around in his chair and start some kind of male dick measuring contest. "How long before we're back online?" He shrugged. "I don't know. 5 minutes? 10? To reboot the system? Unless there's a nuclear war going on out there, in which case it'll probably take longer." "I'll go look for a mushroom cloud," Tabitha Hutter said, getting up off the bench and doing a shuffling sideways walk toward the rear doors. "Yeah," Daltrey said, "me too. If the missiles are flying, I want to smoke before we get wiped out." Hutter turned the latch, opened the heavy metal door to the damp night, and jumped down. Mist hung beneath the streetlights. The night throbbed with insect song. Across the street, fireflies lit the ferns and weeds in gassy green flashes. Daltrey lowered himself down beside her. His knees cracked. "Christ," he said. "I thought for sure I'd be dead of something at this age." His company did not cheer her, but only made her more conscious of her own aloneness. Hutter had believed she would have more friends by now. The last man she dated said something to her shortly before they broke up. "I don't know, maybe I'm boring, but I never really feel like you're there when we're out to dinner. You live in your head. I can't. No room for me in there. I don't know. Maybe you'd be more interested in me if I were a book." She had hated him at the time, and hated herself a little. But later, looking back, Hutter had decided that even if that particular boyfriend had been a book, he would have been one from the business and finance aisle, and she would have passed him by and looked for something in SF and fantasy. Hutter and Daltrey stood together in the almost empty parking lot. She could see into the Citgo through the big plate glass windows. The Pakistani behind the cash register kept flashing them nervous looks. Hutter had told him he wasn't under surveillance, that the federal government thanked him for his cooperation, but he almost certainly believed that his phone was tapped and they were eyeing him as a potential terrorist.
You think you should have gone to Pennsylvania? Daltrey asked.
Depending on how this turns out, I might go tomorrow.
Fucking horror show, Daltrey said.
Hutter had been getting voicemails and emails all night about the house on Block Lane in Sugar Creek. They had the place covered in a tent, and you had to wear a rubber suit and a gas mask to get through the door. They were treating the joint like it was contaminated with Ebola. A dozen forensics experts were in there, state and federal, pulling the place apart. They had been excavating bones from one wall of a root cellar all afternoon. The guy who had lived there, Bing Partridge, had melted most of the remains with lye. What he couldn't destroy, he stored, much the way a bee stores honey, in little cells, lightly mudded over. He had not gotten around to dissolving his most recent kill, a guy named Nathan Demeter from Kentucky, the corpse that Vic McQueen had mentioned on the phone. He had vanished a little more than 2 months ago, along with his vintage Rolls-Royce Wraith. Demeter had picked up the car in a federal auction more than a decade before. Its prior owner was one Charles Talent Manx, former resident at FCI Englewood in Colorado. Demeter had mentioned Manx in the note he'd written shortly before his death by strangulation. He had misspelled the name, but it was pretty clear whom he was talking about. Hutter had seen a scan of the note, had read it herself a dozen times. Tabitha Hutter had learned the Dewey Decimal System and then organized the books in her Boston apartment according to it. She had a plastic box filled with carefully handwritten recipes, ordered by region and food type, main course, appetizers, desserts, and one category labeled PCS for post-coital snacks. She took private, almost guilty pleasure in defragmenting her hard drive. She sometimes imagined her own mind as a futuristic apartment with a clear glass floor, clear glass stairs, furniture made out of clear plastic, everything seeming to float, clean, dustless, ordered. But it wasn't like that now, and when she tried to think about what had happened in the last 72 hours, she felt overwhelmed and confused. She wanted to believe that information brought clarity. Not for the first time in her life, however, she had the disconcerting notion that it was often the opposite. Information was a jar of flies, and when you unscrewed the lid, they went everywhere, and good luck to you trying to round them all up again. Hutter inhaled the mossy-smelling night, shut her eyes, and catalogued the flies. Victoria McQueen had been abducted at age 17 by Charles Manx, a man who had almost certainly kidnapped others. He was at that time driving a Rolls-Royce Wraith, the 1938 model. Vic got away from him, and Manx was jailed for transporting her across state lines and murdering an active-duty soldier. In another sense, Vic had not escaped him at all. Like so many survivors of trauma and probable sexual assault, she was made a prisoner again and again of her addictions, of madness. She stole things, did drugs, bore a child out of wedlock, and burned through a string of failed relationships. What Charlie Manx had not been able to do, she had been trying to do for him ever since. Manx had spent close to 20 years locked up in the FCI Englewood Supermax. After drifting in and out of a coma for most of a decade, he had died this past spring. The coroner had estimated his age at 90. No one knew the exact number. And while he was still cogent, Manx had claimed to be 116 years old. The body had been snatched from the morgue by vandals, creating a minor scandal, but there was no question of his death. His heart had weighed 10.2 ounces, a bit light for a man of his size. Hutter had seen a photograph of it. McQueen claimed she had been assaulted again, just 3 days ago, by Charlie Manx and a man in a gas mask, and that these men had driven off with her 12-year-old son in the back of a vintage Rolls-Royce. It had been reasonable to doubt her story. She'd been badly beaten, but her injuries might have been inflicted by a 12-year-old struggling for his life. There were tire tracks on the lawn, but they could have been made by her motorcycle as easily as by a car. The soft, wet earth held no usable prints. She claimed she'd been shot at, but forensics had failed to recover a single bullet. Also, more damningly, McQueen had secretly contacted a woman, Margaret Lee, a Heartland hooker and drug addict who seemed to have information about the missing child. When McQueen was confronted about Lee, she fled on a motorcycle, taking nothing. and had disappeared as if she'd dropped down a mine shaft. Miss Lee had been impossible to locate. She had drifted through a series of shelters and halfway houses in Iowa and Illinois. Had not paid taxes or held a job since 2008. Her life had an unmistakably tragic arc. Once she had been a librarian and a beloved, if eccentric, local Scrabble competitor. Lee also once held a reputation as something of an amateur psychic, of occasional use to law enforcement. What did that mean? Then there was the hammer. The hammer had been on Hutter's mind for days. The more she learned, the heavier that hammer weighed in her thoughts. If Vic were going to make up a story about being attacked, why not say Max had come at her with a baseball bat, a shovel, a crowbar? Instead, McQueen described a weapon that had to be a bone mallet, just like the one that had gone missing with Manx's body, a detail that had never appeared in any news report. Finally, there was Lewis Carmody, Vic McQueen's occasional lover, father of their child, the man who had driven her away from Charlie Manx all those years ago. Carmody's stenosis was not a put-on. Hutter had spoken to the doctor who treated him, and she had confirmed he had suffered from one, possibly two, pre-stroke events in the space of a week. "He should not have left the hospital," the doctor said to Hutter, as if Hutter herself were to blame for his departure. In a sense, she was. Without an angioplasty, any strain on his heart could initiate an ischemic cascade. Do you understand? An avalanche in the brain. A major infarction. "You're saying he could stroke out," Hutter said. "At any minute. Every minute he's out there, he's like a guy lying down in the middle of a road. Sooner or later, he will be run over." And still Carmody had walked out of the hospital, grabbed a cab to the train station half a mile away. There he'd bought a ticket for Boston, presumably in some half-assed attempt to throw law enforcement off, but then walked down the street to a CVS where he made a call to Dover, New Hampshire. 45 minutes later, Christopher McQueen arrived in a pickup, and Carmody got into the passenger seat. And here they were. "So, what do you think Vic McQueen was into?" Daltrey asked. The tip of his cigarette flared in the dark, casting an infernal light on his seamed, ugly face. "Into?" "She made a beeline for this guy, Bing Partridge. She hunted him down to get information about her son, which she did. She said so, didn't she? She was obviously involved with some reprehensible shit buckets. That's why the kid was grabbed, don't you think? She was being taught a lesson by her business partners." "I don't know," Hutter said. "I'll ask her when I see her." Daltrey lifted his head, blew smoke into the pale mist. "I bet human trafficking, or child pornography. Hey, that makes sense, doesn't it?" "No," Hutter said, and began to walk. At first she was just stretching her legs out, restless to move. Walking helped her think. She put her hands in the pockets of her FBI windbreaker and took herself around the deli truck, down to the edge of the highway. When she looked across the road, she could see a few lights from Christopher McQueen's house through the pines. The doctor said that Carmody was lying in the road, waiting to get run down, but that wasn't quite right. It was worse than that. He was strolling up the middle of the street, willfully walking right into oncoming traffic, because there was something at this house that he needed. No, correction, that Wayne needed. It was important enough that all other considerations, including Lou's own continued survival, could be set aside. It was there in that house. It was 200 feet away. Daltrey caught up to her as she was crossing the road. "So what are we doing now?" "I want to sit with one of the surveillance crews," Hutter said. "If you're coming, you'll have to put out that cigarette." Daltrey dropped it in the road and stepped on it. When they were across the highway, they walked along the gravel margin. They were 40 feet from the drive to Christopher McQueen's cabin when a voice called. "Ma'am?" someone said softly. A small, stout woman in a midnight blue rain jacket stepped from under the boughs of a spruce. It was the Indian woman, Chitra. She held a long, stainless steel flashlight in one hand, but she didn't switch it on. "It's me, Hutter. Who's here?"
"Myself and Paul Hoover and Gibran Peltier."
They were one of two teams positioned in the trees, watching the house. "Something's wrong with the equipment. The bionic dish quit. The camera won't turn on."
"We know," Daltrey said.
"What happened?"
Chitra asked.
"Sunspot," Daltrey said.
Christopher McQueen's house.
Vic left the Triumph by the trees on a slight rise above her father's house. When she stood up from the bike, the world lurched. She had a sensation of being a small figure in a glass snow globe, being tilted this way and that by an insensitive toddler. She started down the slope and was surprised to find she could not walk in a straight line. If a cop pulled her over, she doubted she could pass a basic sobriety test, never mind that she had not had a drop to drink. Then it occurred to her that if a cop pulled her over, he would probably cuff her and give her a couple of swats with a nightstick while he was at it. Her father's shape was joined at the back door by that of a big, broad-chested man with an immense stomach and a neck thicker than his shaved head. Lou. She could have picked him out of a crowd from 500 feet away. Two of the three guys who had loved her in her life, watching her make her unsteady way down the hill. The only one missing was Wayne. Men, she thought, were one of the world's few sure comforts, like a fire on a cold October night, like cocoa, like broken-in slippers. Their clumsy affections, their bristly faces, and their willingness to do what needed to be done, cook an omelet, change light bulbs, make with hugging, sometimes almost made being a woman fun. She wished she were not so aware of the vast gulf between what the men in her life thought she was worth and her actual value. She had, it seemed to her, always asked and expected too much and given too little. She seemed almost to have a perverse impulse to make anyone who cared about her regret it, to find the thing that would most appall those people, and then do that until they had to run away as a matter of self-preservation. Her left eye felt like a great screw, slowly turning, twisting tighter and tighter in her eye socket. For a dozen steps, her left knee refused to bend. Then, halfway across the backyard, it folded without warning and she dropped down onto it. It felt as if Manx were smashing it with his hammer. Her father and Lou came spilling out the door, hurrying toward her. She waved a hand in a gesture that seemed to mean, "Don't worry about it, I'm cool." She found, however, that she could not stand back up. Now that she was down on one knee, the leg would not unfold. Her father looped one arm around her waist. He pressed his other hand against her cheek. "You're burning up," he said. "Jesus, woman, let's get you inside." He took one arm and Lou took the other and they hauled her to her feet. She turned her head against Lou for a moment and inhaled deeply. His round, grizzled face was wan, greasy with damp, beads of rainwater all over his bald skull. Not for the first time in her life. She thought he had missed his century and his country. He would have made a fine little John and would have been perfectly at ease fishing in Sherwood Forest. "I would be so happy for you," she thought, "if you found someone worth loving, Lou Carmody." Her father was on her other side, his arm around her waist. In the dark, well away from his little log house, he was the same man he had been when she was a kid. The man who joked with her while he put band-aids on her scrapes, and who took her for rides on the back of his Harley. But as he stepped into the light, spilling from the open back door, she saw a man with white hair and a face made gaunt with age. He had a regrettable mustache and leathery skin, the skin of a lifelong smoker, with deep lines etched into his cheeks. His jeans were loose and baggy on his non-existent ass and pipe-cleaner legs. "What's that pussy tickler doing on your face, Dad?" she asked. He shot her a surprised sidelong look, then shook his head. Opened his mouth and closed it. Shook his head again. Neither Lou nor her father wanted to let go of her, and so they had to turn sideways to shuffle in through the door. Chris went first and helped her over the door sill. They paused in a back hallway, a washer and dryer on one side, some pantry shelves on the other. Her father looked at her again. "Oh, Vic," he said, "what in God's name's been done to you?" And he shocked her by bursting into tears. It was noisy, choked, unpretty crying that shook his thin shoulders. He cried with his mouth open so she could see his metal fillings in the back of his teeth. She felt a little like crying herself, could not believe she looked any worse than he did. It seemed to her she had last seen him only a while ago. It felt like last week. And he had been fit, limber, and ready, with calm, pale eyes that suggested he wouldn't run from anything. Although he had run. And so what? She had not done any better herself. By many measures, she had probably done worse. "You should see the other guy," she said. Her father made a choked sound halfway between a sob and a laugh. Lou looked back out through the screen door. The night beyond smelled of mosquitoes, an odor a bit like stripped wire, a bit like rain.
"We heard a noise," Lou said, "like a bang."
"I thought it was a backfire or a gun going off," her father said.
Tears streamed down his leathery cheeks, hung gem-like in his bushy, tobacco-stained mustache. All he needed was a gold star in his chest and a pair of Colt revolvers.
"Was that your bridge?" Lou asked, his voice soft and gentle with wonder. "Did you just come across?"
"Yes," she said. "I just came across." They helped her into the small kitchen. Just one light was on, a smoked glass dish hanging over the table. The room was as tidy as a show kitchen, the only sign that anyone lived here the smushed filters in the amber ashtray and the haze of cigarette smoke in the air. And the ampho. The ampho was on the table in an unzipped school backpack, a mass of 20-kilo sacks. The plastic was slippery and white, covered in warning labels. They were packed tight and smooth. Each was about the size of a loaf of bread. Vic knew without lifting them that they would be heavy, like picking up bags of unmixed concrete. They eased her into a cherrywood chair. She stretched out her left leg. She was conscious of an oily sweat on her cheeks and forehead that could not be wiped away. The light over the table was too bright. Being near it was like someone gently forcing a sharpened pencil back through her left eye and into her brain. "Can we turn that off?" she asked. Lou found the switch, flipped it, and the room was dark. Somewhere down a hall, another lamp was on, casting a brownish glow. She didn't mind that one so much. Outside, the night throbbed with peepers, a sound that made Vic think of a great electrical generator humming in pulses. "I made it go away," she said. "The bridge. So no one could follow me across it. That's why I'm warm. I've been across it a few times in the last 2 days. It makes me a little feverish. It's okay, though. It's nothing." Lou sank into a chair across from her. The wood creaked. He looked ridiculous, sitting at the little wooden table, like a bear in a tutu. Her father leaned against the kitchen counter, his arms crossed over his slender, sunken chest. The darkness, she thought, was a relief to them both. Here they were both shadows, and he could be himself again, the man who sat in her bedroom when she was sick and told her stories about places he had gone on his motorcycle, scrapes he'd been in. She could be the person she was when they shared the same house, a girl she liked very much, missed very much, and with whom she had little in common.
"You used to get like this when you were small," her father said, his thoughts perhaps running along the same course. "You'd come in from riding around town on your bike, usually with something in one hand, a lost doll, a lost bracelet, and you'd be a little warm and telling lies. Your mom and I used to talk about it all the time, about where you went. We thought maybe you had light fingers, that you were, borrowing things, then bringing them back when people noticed they were gone."
"You didn't think that," she said. "You didn't think I was out stealing."
"No, I guess that one was mostly your mother's theory."
"What was your theory?"
"That you were using your bike like a dowsing rod. You know about dowsing rods? Old-timers in these parts would get a piece of yew or hazel and wave it around looking for water. Sounds crazy, but where I grew up, you didn't dig a well without talking to a dowser first."
"You're not too far off. You remember the shorter way?" He lowered his head in thought. In profile, he looked almost exactly like the man he had been at 30.
"Covered bridge," he said. "You and the other kids used to dare each other to cross it. Thing gave me fits. Looked ready to fall into the river. They took it down, 1985?
86. Except it never really came down for me. When I needed to find something, I could ride out into the woods and it would reappear, and I could go across it to whatever was missing. As a kid, I used my Raleigh. Remember the tough burner you got me for my birthday?
It was too big for you," he said.
"I grew into it, like you said I would." She paused, then nodded back in the direction of the screen door. "Now I've got my triumph out there. Next time I go across the shorter way bridge, it'll be to meet Charlie Manx. He's the one who has Wayne." Her father did not reply. His head remained bowed. "For what it's worth, Mr. McQueen," Lou said, "I believe every crazy-ass word."